Ever wonder what psychologists talk about over coffee? I'm Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, where I specialize in rehab and health psychology and acceptance and commitment therapy.
And I'm Diana Hill, a clinical psychologist in Seaside, Santa Barbara, California, where I specialize in mindfulness and values-based approaches to therapy.
In this podcast, we bring psychology research into practice by discussing topics from psychology with experts in the field and with each other. You'll get a glimpse into the books we read, the research we think is interesting, and the ideas from psychology that we use to thrive in our own lives.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. Hey, Denny.
Hi, Diana.
Well, I know you've had a really busy last couple of weeks, so this episode today is probably going to be perfect for you because it's all about rest. And I was wondering, what do you do to rest?
Yeah, well, this is a really good example because the last couple of weeks have been really busy. I've traveled, I led a workshop, I was solo parenting for several days right before I left town. We got a dog in the middle of it. So it's been very busy. And so I had a perfect day today. It was kind of rainy and cold spring day here in Denver. And I, you know, pretty much stayed in my jammies all day, read books to my kids, made pancakes, you know, played with the puppy. It's just been one of those days where I just had a long to-do list that I ignored. And I just kind of hung around the house.
That sounds wonderful.
Good timing in that sense. I got to the first time I've had a chance to rest in a while.
Yeah.
How about you? What do you do to rest?
All sorts of things. I really like to walk. So just going for a slow walk with my family. Sometimes after dinner, we'll walk down to the mailbox and back. And having an evening walk is a really nice, restful time. And I also really enjoy reading to my kids. I find that extremely restful and peaceful, climbing into bed with them and reading Harry Potter, sort of our big one, the series that we're on, or Winnie the Pooh, my little one. So that's really restful too. And today we're having our guest interviewer, Yael Shungren, to do an interview with the author of a book called Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less by Alex Soojung King Pang. And Yael is a frequent contributor to our podcast. And of all people that I know, it's really ironic that she chose the book Rest because she's a mother of three. She's a professor at Brown. She has a private practice. She's writing her own book. And it's kind of ironic that she chose this topic herself.
Yeah, maybe there's some desire to rest a little bit somewhere in there, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
It sounds like she probably doesn't get much.
Yeah. So I look forward to listening to her interview and learning a little bit more about how we can rest more effectively.
That sounds good. And can you remind us about your workshop, Diana, that you have coming up in Santa Barbara?
Oh, thanks a lot. So it's in the end of May, Memorial Day weekend on Sunday from 1 to 4 at Yoga Soup. And it's in a workshop on acceptance and commitment training. So it's really for the general public as well as for practitioners. You'll be learning all about ACT, applying ACT to your own life and really using some of the skills on yourself, maybe developing some more contact with the present moment, identifying what your values are, getting moving in the direction of your values. So you can learn more about it and sign up at yogasoup.com or through my website, which is drdianahill.com.
Great. Thank you, Diana. And we are looking forward to listening to this interview ahead with Yael on rest.
Great.
Hi, this is Dr. Yael Shungren in Boston, and I'm excited to talk today with author, founder of The Restful Company, and visiting scholar at Stanford, Dr. Alex Pang. We are going to be discussing Dr. Pang's wonderful book, Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. You can find Rest in your bookstore, and I see that the paperback version will be out in June with a foreword by Arianna Huffington. So, Alex, welcome. The title of your book caught my attention because I come across the issue of work burnout in my private practice all the time, and of course, confront it in my own busy life as well. And as I read the chapters, I found myself getting more and more excited about the concept of how rest and work are really important complements to one another. You write that rest is not work's adversary, rest is work's partner. They complement and complete each other. So I wonder if you could start us out by sharing how you started to explore this idea of deliberate rest and its relationship to work.
So, first of all, thanks for having me on. But the origin story for the book was actually a sabbatical that I took a few years ago. I've lived in Silicon Valley for the last almost 20 years, and have worked mainly as a technology forecaster and futurist and consultant. And about in my previous job, after about 8 or 9 years of juggling projects and doing a lot of travel and client engagements, essentially I had burned out and had an opportunity to take a step back and go to Microsoft Research Cambridge. Microsoft has a bunch of research centers in different parts of the world, and I sort of knew someone who ran a research group there, and presumably, the four other people who they'd really wanted said no, so I got lucky. But I went over there to do the work that eventually became my second book, a book about technology and distraction called The Distraction Addiction. And a few weeks into it, I realized that I was getting an incredible amount of stuff done. I was doing all this reading. I was getting into new literatures. I felt like a lot of really interesting intellectual stuff was happening, and I was writing plenty, and so I was being really productive. But I also felt like I didn't have the sense of time pressure that was, second nature to sort of life in Silicon Valley. Started me thinking that, maybe our default assumptions about what you have to do in order to do really good work, namely to put in Herculean hours, to be in this state of kind of continuous partial attention, as Linda Stone puts it, to meet challenges by layering them on top of each other and doing more and more. Maybe that attitude actually was backwards, that maybe in order to do really good work, what you had to do was actually to follow a different strategy, a different path. And I started looking at the lives of really creative people, right? Nobel Prize winners, or famous artists, some military leaders, people of kind of unquestionable accomplishment. And I realized when I started diving into their lives that a lot of these amazingly creative folks had these periods where when they were younger, they worked immensely hard, right? You stayed up until 2 or 3 writing your novel, and that worked for a little while. And then they almost to a person, they had some kind of crisis, some moment of burnout, and they came out the other side and discovered a different way of working, one that was much more balanced, one that alternated periods of intensive focus with what I call in the book deliberate rest, and which in a lot of ways resembled the life that I kind of stumbled on this sabbatical. The other thing that made me realize that there actually was a story worth telling was coming upon the literature on the neuroscience of the resting brain and recent work in the psychology of mind-wandering creativity, which did two things. I mean, first off, it established that actually there's an awful lot of really interesting stuff that goes on mentally when we are apparently doing nothing at all. We're just kind of spacing out. Even when we're napping or sleeping, our brains are really busy. And that this work could explain why it was that whether you were, X-ray crystallographer Rosalind Franklin or Charles Darwin or Stephen King, why it was that doing things like having a daily schedule where you work really hard for several hours and then you apparently do nothing for an equal amount of time helps you be more productive and more creative than you would be if you were to try and work at a high, fast pace constantly. So when all that came together, I realized actually there's a story here that's worth telling, and that you can tell in a way that, you know, one that I hope will be convincing to people who need to hear it.
Absolutely. And I think that your argument really is so convincing. And you talk a bit about this in your book, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this for our podcast audience. Why do you think that rest is such a problem in our modern day society? Because you've just kind of listed some really compelling reasons to value rest, and yet we continue to push against it. And I wonder if you could kind of articulate your understanding of that.
Right. Well, and I think that the part of the reason that it is so difficult to back away from the idea that, you know, overwork is both an inevitable and inescapable part of modern life, and indeed that there's something kind of noble and desirable about it, is that there's so many different things that work together to make to create the appearance of inevitability. There's a great line in the movie The Usual Suspects where the Kevin Spacey figure says, "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing us that he didn't exist." Mm. Well, you know, I think that the greatest trick that overwork has pulled is making it seem totally natural. And I think that part of the reason for this is that most of us no longer live in a world in which work has natural external limits, right? We don't come in from the fields when the sun goes down or go home when the factory bell, you know, whistle goes off. And so it's easy with knowledge work to just keep doing it, right? Until we feel like we can't do it any longer. Another thing is, I think that's particularly since, you know, the 1970s and 1980s, we've had this model of successful careers that emphasize sort of shorter periods of Herculean work, right? To be successful now does not involve climbing up the ladder, waiting your turn, you know, paying your dues, putting in decades with one company until you finally, you know, get the corner office. But rather, it's more like, you know, the movie Wall Street, where you make an incredible amount of money very quickly, and you know, you're kind of in a race against the next economic downturn or the obsolescence of your own technical skills. That's now the model for how you are successful. And then there are, you know, I think that the technologies that we use have not been our friends either. You know, I think one of the ironies with things like email and smartphones is that they were supposed to allow us to break work up into discrete chunks, right? So that we could play with our schedules as we needed. You worked on projects for a few hours, and then you did kid stuff, and then you went back and, you know, finished up of what you'd been working on previously. But instead, what they've tended to do is kind of grind work into a fine powder that just gets sprinkled across our entire day. And so it is when you are able to carry your office around in your pocket effectively, when you are easily reachable at an instant's notice, it becomes a lot harder to switch off. The fact that, you know, the technical fact that you are all that these things are always on means that you have to be always on too. You know, and then finally, everyone else is doing it, right? And this is, when we think that this is what success looks like, when we think that you've got to do this in order to impress your boss, to, you know, not be a target for the next round of layoffs, in order to get the next promotion, that provides a really compelling internal justification for it. So, for all of those reasons, I think that we've come to see overwork as a norm. And, you know, I think that's, but, you know, unfortunately, however, it turns out that there's a lot of great research that shows that we would be much better off taking a different approach to our work.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so important to kind of pull out the reasons why we've gotten stuck in this trap of overwork so that we can directly confront it. And I think this idea of technology kind of getting in our way, even though it's intended to help us, and then this real experience of social pressure as well as career pressure to kind of keep going is so important to acknowledge so that we can do something about it. Because if we sort of keep blind to it, it keeps us in the same path. One thing that I had been thinking about in sort of the context of always being on, that I also think is kind of a modern dilemma that when we look back on history, really was different a few decades ago and certainly a few centuries ago, is the role that spirituality and religious life plays. Because I do think that there used to be more of a framework that really required people to pause, like for a Sabbath rest, and to take meditative or prayer time to really focus away from work and focus on the spiritual life or on the family life. And I think that infrastructure that really was a part of society has really changed and kind of evaporated, and all mm-hmm. that's left is this pressure to work and without that infrastructure to sort of set boundaries. And I think that what you do in your book, which is so nice, is offer some really lovely ways to create some of that infrastructure, some of those boundaries in a more proactive way, because they don't just inherently exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're absolutely right that one of the benefits of spiritual life or sort of religious observance that maybe we didn't appreciate until sort of we'd lost it was the commandment to rest, right? The legitimation mm-hmm. of taking this rest. You know, I think it's also the case that allowed for a kind of interweaving of work and rest in way a kind of institutionalization of that relationship that we are now forced to reconstruct ourselves individually. I was, you know, I'm really struck when I go to you know, places like London or Amsterdam, and at how many churches there are in the city center, right? You know, in commercial areas. I was giving a talk at a church called the Westerkerk, which is a famous 17th century church. It's right on the canals. And I realized, you know, sort of people would have gone to services there, you know, as the spice-laden and silk-laden ships that were making them all rich would be coming up, you know, the canal right outside the door of the church. And there was a kind of unity of work and rest in the daily lives of these, you know, eventually fabulously rich merchants that is really difficult, I think, to replicate today. You know, I took a look at a map a little while ago, and it is several miles from Facebook or Google headquarters to the nearest house of worship. And you know, which was by no means something that was, you know, intended by anybody. But just as a kind of artifact of the way that we lay out, you know, corporate campuses and we do zoning, we have this kind of physical separation of sort of working life and spiritual life that is very new, and whose consequences I think we are, you know, we have to learn how to live with. So, and I think that, you know, one of the things that the book quietly tries to do is to provide for people who are perhaps not religious or not spiritual, a kind of rationale for taking rest seriously, and for those, you know, who already are, kind of additional rationale for doing so.
Absolutely. Yeah, so you do a lovely job in your book of talking about the different forms that rest can take. And interestingly, I think that you make a really nice explanation for how we often think about rest as a very passive activity, but that rest can actually be active and sometimes even demanding, mm-hmm. as with intense exercise. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the different ways that we can think about rest.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we often think of rest as something that involves sitting on a couch with, you know, a remote in one hand and snacks in the other, and, you know, episode one of you know, several seasons of something that we've been meaning to watch.
It does sound delightful.
Right. I mean, which absolutely has its place. However, it turns out that if you think about what rest is, which is time spent restoring the physical and mental energy that you spend working, and you ask, okay, what kinds of things recharge you most effectively? And it turns out it's not just totally passive stuff, right? And this is one of the things that I was really surprised at in the book, but which I think which turns out to explain an awful lot, is that the most restorative kinds of rest often are physically engaging, they're mentally challenging, and they work because, first of all, you know, for reasons that exercise physiologists can tell you, exercise turns out both to be, you know, physically draining, but also sort of energizing as well. It's also the case that, you know, we often don't recognize it enough, but cognitive work, knowledge work is actually physically really demanding, right? Your brain needs a lot of oxygen. It needs a lot of energy in order to work well. And the better you are the better your body is at providing that, the better off, basically the better your brain is going to operate. But the other thing is that forms of recreation, forms of rest that are mentally intensive or physically intensive are often ones that provide a greater sense of what psychologists call detachment, which is the kind of psychological sense of being away from work, right? Not being able to think about it because your mind is occupied by something else. And that is a really important component to getting good rest. If you are, you know, if you're doing something passive and your mind keeps kind of going back to problems you've got at work or something that's, you know, something that's been bothering you, you're going to rest less effectively than if you're doing something that is really that you're really mentally and psychologically immersed in. And so for all of those reasons, active rest turns out to have sort of offer a bigger bang for your buck than just sitting on the couch. So
yeah, I love that. I mean, there's something so paradoxical about so many elements of your argument, but this idea of engaging in more active rest so that you are more fully detached from work, I think flies in the face of what we often think about, which is this, again, kind of going back to your original argument, that we assume that more availability to work allows us to be more effective. But the evidence really suggests the exact opposite, which is that by taking a full step away and really immersing ourselves in an activity that is sort of takes us away from work physically and mentally and emotionally, that is really where we can recharge our work batteries and come back more prepared to and more able to be effective, creative, productive, efficient, and all of those kinds of things that really serve us well mm-hmm. in the workspace.
Exactly right. And I think the evidence is also pretty compelling that the sort of more intensive your work, the more you like your work, the more important it is to have a break from it. Because high performers, ambitious people are more prone to breakdowns and burnouts because they kind of voluntarily overwork than people who are kind of, you know, come in and do their thing and then go home and it's no big deal. So, you know, the fact that you love your job and you want to be good at it does not mean that you should do that and only that. You'll actually do a better job over the long run if you learn how to get some time away, some time to yourself.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that you discussed this concept of deep play that I think is a really interesting idea, that, you know, finding something that is mentally immersive, that challenges you, that is very different from work, but that in some ways can tie back into work, is one mm-hmm. form of active rest. And I love some of the examples that you give. One of the things that I often think about as somebody who thinks a lot and certainly in my life engages in the tension between work and parenting life is I wonder what you think about the idea of parenting being kind of some form of deep play. You sort of make reference to it, I think, when you're talking about J.R.R. Tolkien a little bit. But mm-hmm. I wonder if you've thought some about that.
You know, as I have two teenagers, and I would describe sort of parenting is something that gets easier as you get older. I've never really thought, you know, and it is incredibly rewarding. And it is certainly the most important thing I think I'll ever do in my life. But, you know, I haven't really thought of it so much as deep play, though perhaps the fact that I haven't sort of gone nuts and like sold the kids suggests that, perhaps I should. I think that one of the features of deep play, and I think one of the things that it's defining feature, is that deep play gives people a sense provides rewards that are in some ways similar to the rewards that they get when work goes well, but in a very different kind of medium and often at a different pace. And I think that's critical because, you know, when you are, let's say, a scientist, you know, you are spending a lot of time in the lab, you're doing these meticulous experiments, they may last for years, and the result is sometimes, well, maybe, you know, the hypothesis might be correct. And, you know, I think that, for people who want to, you know, uncover the mysteries of the universe, those kinds of results can be really frustrating. On the other hand, you can find those rewards much more quickly doing things like, you know, mountain climbing, for example, which turns out to be something that disproportionate number of scientists are really into. And when they talk about climbing, it turns out that they talk about it in the same way that they talk about science, right? It's incredibly mentally engaging. You're taking this big problem and you're breaking it down to a million little pieces. You've got to focus on each one of them. There's a technical dimension to it. So in a lot of ways, it offers the same rewards as science, but by the end of the day, either you've made it to the top or you haven't. There's an incredible clarity to your success, and it happens very quickly. And when you look at people who are CEOs or successful actors or scientists or writers, and you look at their pastimes, it's often the case that the really ambitious ones have these hobbies that look dangerous, time-consuming, expensive, and kind of paradoxical, because, you know, you would think, okay, you know, people who know that they're in a race to win a Nobel Prize or a Pulitzer shouldn't be spending this time doing, you know, sort of taking a month off and going hiking in the Andes. But I think that deep play helps explain why it is that these investments are worthwhile and why it is that they are worth undertaking. Now, you know, I think that the other thing about parenting that makes it challenging for it to be a kind of deep play is that for so many of us, there are high standards around it, right? It's not just keep the kid from becoming a child soldier or dying of an easily communicable disease, turning into a psychopath, right? We don't just have to meet these very minimal standards, but rather, you know, our kids have to be great. And we have to take upon ourselves responsibility for crafting these wonderful lives and wonderful experiences for them. And I think that sets up a set of expectations and a set of challenges that makes parenting a lot more like work than it might otherwise be. And I think this is especially true for women, right? And I think that sort of we live in a world in which the challenges of being both professionally successful and being good parents are big for everyone, but they're gigantic for women for, you know, a bunch of reasons. This, you know, the sort of the most fundamental of which is you're often expected to start both of these things, right? Start families and start your careers roughly at the same time, and then to raise kids as if you don't have a job and to work as if you don't have children. Yeah. What could possibly go wrong with that system, right? And I think also that that there is the other thing is that there's good evidence that men are simply better socialized at figuring out ways of gaming the system. There's this so that they don't to take off some of this pressure. There's this wonderful study of men and women's or a performance at a consulting company where they look and how they balanced work-life issues. And it turned out that what was going on was that junior partners who were women were taking advantage of formal programs, right? They were going on halftime. They were doing the various things that the company had offered. And often they were suffering professionally as a result. The men, on the other hand, who were young fathers, were doing stuff like trading with each other on projects so that, you know, they didn't have to fly to Munich every 2 weeks to do status reports, so that they could continue to look busy even while they were managing their workload. The other thing was that if a man was out of the office, generally the partners assumed he was out pitching clients, whereas if a woman was out, the assumption was, right, she's picking up the kids. And so the combination of this greater space and greater willingness to exploit the gaps made it easier for men to look like they were hard charging and successful without looking like they were all having to make any sacrifices. And I think that study did a really nice job of revealing something that I think is true in many offices. So which I think further contributes to the separation of parenting from deep play.
Yeah. So for you, you really, you know, kind of don't see parenting as a form of deep play, but there are lots of other ways that you do envision deep play being available to people. And you just more generally talk about rest as a skill that is useful to develop and strategies to developing. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about sort of in what way do you think of rest as a skill? That's sort of, a novel concept.
Right. Now, I think that it certainly is novel, but when you get into it, I think rest turns out to be kind of like running or breathing, right? Sort of breathing is something that absolutely everybody knows how to do. But if you are, let's say, a professional athlete, a swimmer, an opera singer, you know how to use your breath in order to improve your performance. If you are, a Buddhist monk, you know a lot about how breathing affects your level of calm or excitement, helps you be centered. And so breathing is at once something that is incredibly natural, but also is something that we can learn to use in order to either be better at work, to be faster, to be better versions of ourselves. And likewise, I think that it's useful to think of rest as a skill in the sense that we can learn to do it better. We can learn to incorporate it into our lives in order to both get more pleasure from it, to be more restored by it, and also to tap into its capacity to help us be more creative. And it's a challenge that I think we can renew throughout our lives, right? The sort of the place of rest changes depending upon what other stuff we've got going on, how busy we are, sort of whether we have more or less control over our daily schedules. And so I think that that in all of those ways, thinking of rest as something that is a skilled activity rather than something that's unskilled helps us make better use of it. It helps us take it more seriously, and kind of underlines its importance in our everyday lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in the book, you review a lot of the brain science research that clearly indicates that we can give our brains an advantage in creative and productive thinking when we rest. And I would love it if you would just spend a few minutes talking about what some of the neuroscience findings are, because I think they're just fascinating and kind of surprising, actually.
Yes. So, you know, one of the big bodies of research that I draw on is on what neuroscientists call the default mode network. So it turns out, you know, when you kind of zone out and don't think about anything in particular, you know, just kind of let your attention go wherever, you feel like your brain is kind of shutting down, but it actually isn't. And what you find when you put people in fMRI machines and watch brain activity is that their brains don't slow down or go quiet, but rather a second network, what they call the default mode network, of kind of connections between sort of different brain regions activates. So, and it turns out that we are basically about as active, our brains are roughly as active when we are apparently resting as it is when sort of we're like trying to do math problems. And so that discovery from, you know, about 20 years ago is one that that has led people to try and figure out, okay, so, you know, are there differences in the way that the default mode network is put together in different kinds of people? Are there things that, you know, are there signatures that correlate with higher degrees of creativity or lower degrees? And it turns out, actually, there are, that there are, you know, sort of the resting brains of highly creative people are different from those of people who are less creative in somewhat the same way that, you know, let's say, rugby players or, you know, ballerinas are different from couch potatoes. There are parts of the, so you get higher levels of activation in areas that are associated with visual thinking, with innovation, or with divergent thinking, and lower levels of connection to those parts of the brain that essentially kind of edit our thoughts, say, oh, that idea is, you know, that idea is no good. And so the result is that it looks like that among highly creative people, default mode networks work a little differently. Now, it also seems like that is something that we can kind of, that's not something that you're born with. It's something that you can develop.
Right. So that's sort of the skill development part of it.
Precisely. And in a way, you know, we think of like creative thinking or, you know, those aha moments that we all have, whether they are very small versions of, you know, who is the actor who is in that thing, who is in that movie? And the answer is, you know, Hugh Jackman, right? But, you know, the answer doesn't come to you immediately. You're trying to remember. And then a few minutes later when you're doing something else, wait a minute, it's Hugh Jackman. That's the default mode network continuing to work on the problem even while you have turned your conscious attention to something else. And while that looks mysterious, it actually turns out the capacity to use the default mode network that way is a bit like learning language, right? Language is this incredibly complicated thing that we all acquire when we're relatively young. And we don't do it because we set out to do it. We learn language because we hear our parents talking and we hear other people talking and we want things and we begin to experiment. And then at a certain point, you know, sort of our brains develop this amazing capacity to, you know, pick up hundreds of words a year, and we learn grammar, or if you're Noam Chomsky, we're born with grammar. But anyway, and you know, language is this phenomenally complicated thing that that you know literally changes the way that your brain works, but which we all can which we can all acquire, and it's a set of abilities that we can all refine. Likewise, I think it turns out that our capacity to think innovatively, or rather to use the default mode network to and our ability to tempt it to work on problems even while we are working on other things, that likewise looks almost magical or mystical, but it actually turns out to be something that we can learn how to do. We can learn how to do a little better. There are actually are lots of stories of people who develop all kinds of techniques for helping this along. You know, Salvador Dali famously had this thing about where he would take naps after lunch. These were very, long Spanish lunches with a lot of wine. So, you know, a nap afterwards was, you know, was often a necessity. But he would hold in his hand a key, and a heavy key. And as he started to drift off to sleep, he would have these, you know, sort of surreal images, right? This being Salvador Dali. He would start to fall asleep. The key would slip from his hand, fall on the floor, and wake him up. And then he would sketch out those images. And then he would do it again, and you know, again for you know an hour or so. And he talked about this as a technique for essentially discovering the painting that his subconscious mind had already completed in the you know in the days previous to him taking up the brush and starting work on it. But it was a technique that. That he talked about as one that really, you know, anybody could learn. Linus Pauling, you know, the only person so far to win two Nobel Prizes by himself, likewise had this method, slightly less mysterious and apparently involving less wine, where he would, he would spend time before bed thinking about a particular technical problem that was bothering him that he was working on. And he said, you know, he would do this for a few nights, and then eventually the answer would come to him. He was really conscious about kind of priming his creative unconscious mind to take up these problems while he was sleeping, to take them up in odd moments, and he trusted that that he would be able. Or his subconscious mind would be able to solve these problems on his behalf. So I think this is, you know, it's a. I think that you know, one of the things that that the book tells us is that this is an ability that we ought to take seriously, and that we can actually you know, treat as something that we can learn to do and learn to do better. Just like, you know, Dali and Linus Pauling.
I love that. I'm just curious, as a working parent, I personally find it hard, practically speaking, to build and rest. You know, I have three small children. Mm-hmm. They wake me early. You know, you talk a bit about morning routines. It's practically a little challenging to wake up before my one-year-old. I have several demanding professional roles. And just, you know, a sense that I'm always falling behind, which is kind of that social pressure. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. I know you do a lot of consulting with, you know, prominent executives in Silicon Valley. What are ways that you advise people who simply feel too busy and have a lot of demands to find ways to incorporate rest into their days?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the challenge of remaining productive or indeed remaining human when you have small children is like the hard problem in human existence. Yeah. And
thank you for that validation.
I mean, honestly, that's it. You know, I love children. You know, children are wonderful. Children, you know, you can learn incredible amounts about yourself from, you know, sort of as a parent. It is astonishing to watch kids learn how to do even the simplest things. At the same time, however, children are also vampires. Children will, or if children will kill you in all kinds of ways by, you know, sucking up as much time and energy as, you know, as they can get. Their capacity for that apparently is absolutely limitless, and there is simply no satisfying the, you know, delightful little creatures. So now, so, you know, the reality is that as great as they are, you know, they're an awful lot of work. And I think that we, you know, we often underestimate that. And we should, you know, and we ought to, I think we should recognize when we are challenged to do all these things at the same time, that there's a really good reason for it, right? It's not that we don't have the energy or that we're not smart enough or that we haven't figured out like the right, you know, sort of work-life balance tip. It's because this is an incredibly difficult thing to do. So, having said that, I think that the, you know, the key for people who don't have very much control over their time generally, and this applies whether you're a parent, whether you're, you know, in law enforcement or you're an ER, you know, an ER nurse, is you're not going to be able to like take 2 hours in the middle of the day the way that, you know, Stephen King or Scott Adams did. So what you have to do is push the deliberate rest to nights and weekends and vacations, number one. Number two, be really protective of that time. The studies that indicate there are lots of studies that indicate that people who are good at practicing detachment are both better when they come back to work on Monday and are less likely to suffer from things like burnout. They have higher promotion rates. There are all kinds of good things, both in the short term and in the long term, that come from from simply taking your weekends really seriously. And finally, take all the vacation time that you are allowed. The fact that people, you know, Americans leave something like $50 billion worth of vacation time on the table every year, and this is the stupidest thing, stupidest thing in the world. And you know, vacations are not like something that you're, you know, time that you're stealing away from your employers. You know, they're a time when you get back the energy that you need in order to do a good job. Now, you know, my memory is that a vacation with a 2-year-old, you know, much less multiple kids, is a lot less relaxing than the vacation when either they're older and they're ignoring you because they're, you know, like Snapchatting with their friends about how stupid it is that they're, you know, that they're having to go to, you know, the Grand Canyon, or when it's just, you know, you and your partner. However, you know, I think that, you know, you do the, in those circumstances, you do the things that, you know, decent spouses or partners do, which is, you know, you work out a schedule where you dump the kids on the other person and, you know, for a while, and you get to go off and just be yourself. You know, an awful lot. It's amazing how much of parenting basically is just playing zone defense and dividing labor. And I think that that the benefits of doing that when you are, when you're on vacation, should not be overestimated. So,
yeah. Well, I love what you're saying, because I think that, you know, the bottom line is to take the rest seriously and to make it a priority, and in a busy life to find ways to carve it out, even in small ways, even in imperfect ways, and sort of when it comes to parenting, to kind of know that you're playing the long game, but that you need to be able to sustain yourself for the long game, and that rest is a part of that ability to sustain.
Absolutely. No, I think that we often think of rest as something that we'll get when we're done with everything else. The problem is we're never done, right? There is always more to do, or more that we think we ought to be doing. And I think unless you think of rest as something that that is of genuine importance rather than something that's like a nice to have or sort of an afterthought, I think the more that you can recognize the role that good rest plays in helping balance our lives, in helping us actually be more creative, more productive, better parents, the more likely you are to, defend it against a world that will find other uses for that, other uses for that time that may be better for them, but not better for you.
Well, I can't recommend this book highly enough. You go into a lot of these ideas and tips in more detail. But I'm curious, so besides sharing the gospel of rest, what are you working on these days? What can we expect to see next from you?
So in addition to the paperback version of the book coming out in June, the next thing I've got is I've been working on a project looking at companies that have been shortening their work days. So going from going to 4-day weeks or 6-hour days, sometimes even 5-hour days, and asking how it is that they manage to pull this off when they're often working in things like advertising or financial services or software, right? Companies, industries that are notorious for really long hours and overwork as a default state, and what we can learn from them. And so partly it's looking at just the tactics that people use in order to shorten the workday or the work week, and then looking at both the intended benefits and also the more surprising, subtler, unintended ones, and asking, and then finally, thinking about whether this can be a model for all of us in the future. Nearly 100 years ago, John Maynard Keynes and Bertrand Russell and very smart people, were arguing that by now we would be working 15-hour weeks or, 4 hours a day. And clearly that future has gone off the rails. So what I'm interested in is the question of whether it might be possible to get that back, particularly in a future where the future of work seems increasingly uncertain thanks to automation and robotics and artificial intelligence and globalization, whether actually it's time to take something like the 4-hour workday more seriously. So, and figure out how we can get there. So that's the next big project.
Fantastic. I can't wait to hear more about it. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Alex Peng. And if you all are interested in finding out more about Alex, you can find him online at deliberate.rest. You can also follow him on Twitter at rest_book or at askpeng. On Twitter. Are there other ways that folks can contact you or find out more about your work?
Those are the big ones. Okay. There's also Instagram. If there's a social media channel, I almost always managed to grab Ask Pang. So, the blog and Twitter are the best best places to find out more about the work.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been wonderful, and I hope that people pick up that book because it is a great read.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. You can also find us at www.offtheclockpsych.com. That's off the clock, P-S-Y-C-H.com. Music by John Gu and Susie Stevens.